Today we won't have so many tricky identities as last time. Just a little bit more straightforward solution of some boundary value problems involving magnetic media. So I wrote the boundary conditions we derived last time. Make sure you would know how to derive those. Hint, 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 hint. I want to also give the specialized cases for linear media. Right, so for linear media, they simplify to B2 dot N2 hat is equal to B1 dot N2 hat. Remember, we have a medium, and we have medium 1 and medium 2, and these were characterized in terms of the unit vector at the normal pointing in the direction of medium 2, was how our derivation, our coordinate system was set up. And for the parallel component, if we express it in terms of B, we could write it this way, B2 cross N2 hat is equal to mu 2 over mu 1 times B1 cross N2 hat. This is the parallel H boundary condition, assuming there are no surface currents. Right, which we could also write, if we're working with H, as H2 dot N2 hat is equal to mu 1 over mu 2 H1 dot N2 hat, and H2 of course, cross N2 hat, which picks out the parallel component to the surface, is equal to H1 cross N2 hat. Okay, so those are just different ways of writing this, the same boundary conditions. Before we get into details of actually applying these, solving them for some situations, I do want to point out some simple things that are implied by that. Like, let's suppose we have a mu1, which is a high permeability medium, a huge permeability, and mu2 is low permeability. Okay. Then this means we have kind of the following picture of H1 and H2, that if you have some H1 that looks like this in medium 1, just below the surface, then H2 would have a much larger normal component. See if I've got that right. Yeah, from this equation, right? And so in particular, if mu1, if we go to the limit, incredibly larger mu1 compared to mu2, then that means basically outside of a surface, the H just outside of a high permeability medium, H will in medium 2 will be pretty much exactly normal to the surface with a negligible parallel component. So then H2 will be perpendicular to the surface. And moreover, since B2 in this limit, again, where mu1 is very high permeability medium, and mu2 is low, like vacuum or air, then we also can express this in terms of B. So B2 parallel components, which would be mu2 over mu1, B1 parallel components implies that B2's parallel components will be approximately zero in the limit of mu1 going to infinity. And this is analogous to what we saw in electrostatics, where we found that E parallel and D parallel vanish just outside of a conducting surface. Okay, so that's just one kind of qualitative observation about high permeable media. But now we have some partial differential equations for magnetostatics. We have boundary conditions. So what should we do? Maybe we should solve some PDEs and apply those boundary conditions and have fun with it. Life is good. So boundary value problems in magnetostatics. So one option is that we can always write B as the curl of a vector potential. This is absolutely always true. And that means in the, let's say, the most general case, if we're trying to tackle this problem, solving these partial differential equations in the presence of a medium, our most general case has H as going to be some function of B set by whatever the constitutive relations that are applicable to the particular medium we're talking about, either linear medium or could be permanent magnet, ferromagnet, or more complicated situations. But this means in this most general case where we have the curl of H, and H is a function of the curl of A, which is equal to J free, the free current. That's kind of a hard even to visualize how to go about solving that. So basically, this is not so straightforward to try to just in complete generality try to solve this equation. So let's specialize now to a linear medium. Okay, so then we have the curl, right? B is mu H. We have this linear relation. Just as we, as I said for dielectrics, mu might be a more complicated form of linearity. Is that funny or what? It could be a tensor, but Anyway, for today, we will think it's just some homogeneous medium, just a scalar permeability. What? Nothing? Come on. Must be something. So B is mu H, so we have this equation, curl of 1 over mu, curl of A, is J free. And if we use the usual identity for the curl of a curl and assume mu is constant, then we have del of del dot A minus del squared A is mu J free. Or if we go to the Coulomb gauge, where del dot A is 0, we've just got del squared A. We'll talk more about gauges in the next chapter, but you've probably all heard that before. We have minus mu J, meaning J free, is the PDE, which you can now solve and match the boundary conditions and do all that great stuff. So that's kind of the most... I think Jackson writes it as J, so sometimes I lapse into Jackson's notation. Okay, but let's do a case with no J free. Then we can use a different toolkit altogether from what I just wrote down. And this is one of the tricky things about magnetostatics, is there are many different ways you can tackle problems like this. So let's look at some methods specialized only for regions where J free is zero. And that means curl of H is 0. And this means we can write H as the negative's gradient of a scalar potential. It's so different than when the scalar potential we had in electrostatics. So this would be called the magnetic scalar potential. And as you know, it's a lot easier to solve PDEs with scalar functions than vector PDEs, because vectors have all this pointing stuff going on, which is so annoying. So I recommend using this whenever you can. So if H is minus del M, del phi M, right, and del dot B is 0 still and always, then del dot mu H is 0. And so in regions where mu is constant, then we simply have del squared phi M equals 0. And we can use all the standard methods to solve this equation that you've come to know and love from the earlier chapters in electrostatics. So that's the second general method. We'll solve some examples. But let me give a third category of problems. These are the first two categories, A and B. third category is what it would call hard ferromagnets. So here you have a chunk of iron that's been magnetized, say, or some other magnetic material, and basically it's not responding when you apply magnetic field to it. It's just there. It's got this high magnetization density. How do we deal with that? Okay. So let's consider how we would treat this problem in the case where there are, again, no free currents. And basically the problem is that M of X, the magnetization density in the material, is some given function. And of course you have to remember B will not be equal to mu times H now. You've got to get that totally out of your head if you're given a hard ferromagnet. So let's look a little at the equations that result. Del dot B is still zero. You think I'm kidding, but I'm serious about this. So that means it's equal also to mu naught divergence of H plus M. If you remember how we related in the most general case B to H and M. Okay. So we can rewrite that as del dot minus del phi m for H is equal to minus del dot m. And then we have this equation. For the hard ferromagnet case, we have del dot that is equal to that. So can rewrite that, introduce an additional new notation. Del squared of phi m is equal to some scalar function. Let's call that, by analogy with electrostatics, minus rho m. And then the equations, again, they look just like what we've learned how to solve in electrostatics. It's not a charge, though. It's something that is playing the role as though it were a charge, a magnetic charge. There are no magnetic charges, but it plays the role in the math just as though it were a magnetic charge, right? Where rho m is this minus del dot into the magnetization. Is, I think Jackson calls this an effective magnetic charge density. Did I mess up my equation sign? If minus, I mean, for this equation to equal that, rho has to be the negative, doesn't it? Because there's a minus sign here. Am I missing something? This is rho m. And now I move this minus sign to the other side. Isn't that right? Did I make a mistake in my algebra? No.
Maybe so if you move the minus sign in here, so the divergence should be, like the Laplacian should be positive because of the minus in the potential.
H is minus del phi m, right? And that's equal to minus del dot h, which is this, is minus del dot m. You agree with that? And if I call minus del dot m rho m, then I've got minus del squared is equal to rho m. Then I move the minus sign to the other side, and I've got del squared phi is minus rho m. Isn't that all correct? Okay, you agree now. Okay. Okay, so great thing. I mean, we're doing this again and again in this course, right? We see equations that have the same structure, and we can use the same methods. And we can also draw analogies when we see an equation like this and we see the structure, we see a scalar, then just to make it into a notation that it matches what we know how to solve already, we introduce notation like this. Wacky ideas. Because as the Feynman dictum goes, the same equations have the same solutions. So we know how to solve this. Let's just write down the solution from what we know in electrostatics. It's just there's no epsilon naught. So we've got minus 1 over 4 pi, the integral of del prime dot m of x prime over the distance from an observation point x to a source point x prime d cubed x prime. Voila. That's if there are no boundaries, of course. If you just have a source of magnetization, no boundaries to worry about, then you can just add up the magnetic charge in every little differential volume element. It produces a magnetic field. But now, here is a slight twist to this that may not have jumped out at you yet, is that we could sometimes have a discontinuity of the magnetization at a surface. And that will lead to a little change in this, a little extra. We'll treat a case like this. If you have a discontinuity at a surface, right, if we have a chunk of iron, it's going to have a surface. And we can treat such a discontinuity as a surface magnetization. So let me kind of give an example of what I mean by that. So let's basically look at a Gauss's law for the magnetization itself. It's not true what you might have thought, that Gauss's law is only applicable in magnetostatics. Gauss's law is applicable whenever you see an equation like a divergence is equal to a scalar, right? So again, this is only for problems with no free currents. Okay, so let's set this up. So let's begin with del dot m is minus rho m. And now imagine applying this to a surface where we have down below, we have a non-zero magnetization density. And up above, we have no magnetization. And we can set up, so we can draw our magnetization vector below. And now we can set up a Gaussian pillbox of infinitesimal height that contains the surface and has a normal unit vector pointing out into the 0m medium. And if this Gaussian pillbox has area A, right, then we can convert this by integrating over volume and using the divergence theorem to integral of m dot dA is minus the volume integral of rho m of x, or minus m dot n hat at the surface times the area is equal to minus the area times what I'll call sigma m of x, which where sigma m of x is defined to be m dot n hat. And this m dot n hat that came from the Gauss's law integral here, this is behaving as though it were an effective magnetic surface charge density. Again, shouldn't take these words too seriously because then you'll start believing in magnetic monopoles. Don't do that. But it's a way of talking about these equations. So if I combine that with this expression I wrote, we would basically generalize this formula for the magnetic scalar potential, again, only useful in problems with no free currents, that we will have an extra term, 1 over 4 pi, the surface integral of n hat prime dot m of x prime integrated over the surface divided by the distance from the source to the observation points. And in a large class of these problems, again, take a chunk of constant magnetization stuff, this term will be zero. It'll have no divergence inside. And so the entire physics actually will usually in these problems be here. And this term will often vanish. Take a sphere of uniform magnetization, which I'll solve next. This will fit that pattern. Okay, so here's our first example. Yeah. Say that again.
If the divergence of the magnetization is zero, then the equation is the same as case B, where we have no hard ferromagnets. It's just like wages without frequent. It would be the same.
Case B, what was case B again? That was where... I mean, I guess this is sort of a subset of case B in a sense, because the main point of case B was that there's no free current.
Yeah.
That's what allowed us. And still in case C, we still have no surface currents, or no free currents, I mean. Yeah. Okay, example. A pretty interesting problem, because you'll see it ends up with a sort of astonishingly simple final answer. But let's derive it. So everywhere inside a sphere of radius, I think I'm calling it radius A, we have uniform magnetization everywhere inside and no magnetization outside. That's our problem. So let's solve it. Actually, I'm going to solve this two ways. The first way is with the scalar potential method. So we've got curl of H is zero. I had a friend in graduate school, a really bright guy. And every problem he would ever try to solve in E&M kind of amazed me. The first thing he would write down was Maxwell's equations. And anything from there he would just derive that he needed to know. So, I'll pretend I'm Mahito Komoto. He's actually pretty famous. He did the, as a postdoc, the work that won, a Nobel Prize. He's probably annoyed he didn't get the Nobel Prize, too. If life were fair, he probably would have. So, H is minus del phi, as we've been talking, and M is constant inside, so del dot M is zero. So this volume term will vanish, and we'll only have a surface term contributing to the magnetic scalar potential. Okay, so this is equal to that. I won't rewrite it. That's the equation we have to do an integral. And by golly, we know how to do these kind of integrals really well by now. So let's write it out, the details. We're going to just integrate that over the surface. The dot product between the magnetization and the surface normal at every point will be m dot, and hat is m not cos theta. So phi m should be m naught a squared, right? The surface area dA prime is a squared d omega. So we have m naught a squared over a factor 4 pi integral over all the solid angles cos theta prime from that dot product over the distance to an observation point x from that point on the surface. And we have to integrate this over all, every little surface area element. Let's plug in our spherical harmonic expansion for 1 over x minus x prime. That'll make this a very simple problem here. You can kind of see why, because we've got a y1, 0 sitting here. And all those integrals are going to give 0 except one term. That's pretty cool when infinite sums collapse to a single term. So the rest is just details. Having recognized that, we have the sum over L, all L and M, which is going to collapse in a minute. But let's write it out. 4 pi over 2L plus 1. You all have memorized this formula now, right? R lesser to the L, R greater to the L plus 1. Y L M star of theta prime phi prime. And YLM of theta phi. I guess I have an integral somewhere I've got to put. Let's put it here. D omega prime. And, oh, I can't forget my cos theta, which I will rewrite, because I can, 4 pi over 3 to the 1 half, y1, 0, of theta prime, phi prime, is a very appropriate way to write cosine theta prime. And then there will be a YLM of theta phi outside that integral. Okay, this integral is delta L comma 1, delta M comma 0, then, oh, sorry, I wrote too many YLMs. This I should have taken outside. And so plugging that in and sparing you the algebra of simplifying, this looks like m naught a squared over 3 r lesser over r greater squared 4 pi over 3 to the 1 half y 1 0 of the direction of the observation point from the center of the sphere. That's what the vector x is. We've chosen a coordinate system from the center to our observation point. Now, what are r lesser and r greater? Let me remind you, r lesser, of course, is because we were integrating over prime coordinates on the surface, every point of which was r equals a. So r lesser is the minimum of the observation distance and the surface distance. And r greater is the larger of those, the max of r and a. So we're going to end up with two different formulas, one for inside the sphere and one for outside the sphere. So let's do inside first. Phi m at any point inside the sphere, where r is less than a, right, we'll have a is the larger, so we'll have an a squared that'll cancel this a squared in the numerator. And we'll have an r of the observation point, which is inside the sphere somewhere, a distance r from the center. So we will get m naught over 3, a squared over a squared, which will be 1, times r cos theta, which is the z coordinate. Just m naught over 3 times the z coordinate. And so h, the negative gradient of that, is simply minus m naught over 3 unit vector in the z direction. That's the solution of the problem inside the sphere. You get a constant magnetic field h, which is just the negative of the magnetization constant density divided by 3. That's inside. And similarly, B inside is mu naught h plus m. So that will equal 2 mu naught over 3. Okay, so that's the full solution of the inside problem. Now don't forget, even though we're calling H the magnetic field, when you're thinking of what a charged particle responds to classically to a force from a magnetic field, it's the magnetic induction in the Lorentz force. Don't get confused about that. It's never H in the Lorentz force. Okay, so that's the inside problem solved. To do the outside, we just reverse the roles of our lesser and our greater. Now our lesser will be A, our greater will be R. And so phi m outside is going to be m naught A cubed over 3r squared cosine theta. And if I define the total magnetic moment of the sphere, little m, as the volume integral of m e cubed x, in this case, m is constant. That's just 4/3 pi a cubed m. That's the magnetic dipole moment of the sphere, this little m. Then I have a really simple answer for phi m is the magnetic dipole moment dotted into the observation coordinate vector x over 4 pi r cubed. And this will give exactly our usual formula for the magnetic field outside the sphere caused by a point magnetic dipole. It behaves exactly as if that entire dipole moment was not distributed in space. It behaves exactly as if there were a little m at the center. It's really simple, very simple. Magnetic field inside and outside, it's not constant, but it's the field of a point magnetic dipole. And so here is kind of a pictorial diagram I tried to draw on the notes. Inside your lines of magnetic field are going to be looking like this, or actually I should say that's the magnetic induction. And outside you'll have these kind of standard lines of constant B that are appropriate to a magnetic dipole, looking like that, the lines of the B field. Okay, so that's how you can solve this problem with the magnetic scalar potential. Now let's solve it a different way. To get more practice, let's you do the solution using a vector potential instead. So we have A of x, I think we derived this equation earlier, mu naught over 4 pi, the volume integral of the primed curl of m of x prime, d cubed x prime, over the distance source to observation point. But there was a surface term also, which looks like mu naught over 4 pi surface integral m of x prime crossed into n hat prime dA prime over the distance from every differential element on the surface. And again, m is constant. This volume term is zero here. So we just have to do the surface integral again. Let's look at m of x prime from one surface point crossed into the outward normal, n hat prime. This is m 0 z hat unit vector crossed into n hat prime, which if you plug in the form of n hat prime in Cartesian coordinates, you can see and then rewrite it in terms of the polar, spherical polar coordinates, which I'll spare you that algebra and geometry. It ends up to be just m naught sine theta prime phi hat prime. You know, that might not just leap out at you if you haven't done dozens of problems like that. So when you go home tonight, make sure you understand why this is equal to that. You can do it. And remember, phi hat prime can be written in terms of x hat and y hat. I guess I'll do that over here. Prime cross n hat prime, claiming then can be written as m naught sine theta prime minus sine phi prime x hat plus cos phi prime y hat. Right. When I write expressions like that, I often like to do this kind of thing. Okay, if I think I'm going along here, where is the phi hat unit vector pointing? It's pointing in the y hat direction when I'm in the xy plane. And so, yeah, it's plus I double check when I write equations like that if I've got my signs correct. And now we have sitting there sine theta prime sine phi prime, which I can write in terms of spherical harmonics if you look it up in the first in chapter 3 of Jackson, or your favorite place to look up stuff like that. That's a y11 and a y1 minus 1 over 2i with this constant in front. And sine theta prime cos phi prime is likewise minus 8 pi over 3 to 1/2 y11 minus y1 minus 1 over 2. And so we can plug in the spherical harmonic expansion for 1 over x minus x prime. And again, we're going to get that infinite sum is going to collapse to just two terms. So write a of x is mu naught m naught a squared for 4 pi. Volume integral, or rather solid angle integral, and it's a squared, not a volume integral, it's an area integral, which became just a solid angle integral because I already took the a squared out. This would be harder if it was a cylinder. Hopefully no one in their right mind would ever assign for you to do a cylinder problem. That might lead to Bessel functions. We have sum over L and M. We have 4 pi over 2L plus 1. You guys have seen this so many times. You've memorized this formula. X hat prime YLM of X hat. And R lesser to the L over R greater to the L plus 1. And now we would plug in these formulas and those. You don't really want to see me do that. Let me just write the answer and spare you one or two lines of algebra because I'm lazy. What? I'm sorry?
I just was thinking about it, but in cylindrical coordinates.
Oh, yeah.
I already know that will be in the final. Like last time, your professor could put you this in the exam. Boom.
You think I'm that simple? Pretty dangerous, actually, to second guess. Like I've had students, sometimes I had a problem so easy on a problem, and students were sitting there and overthinking it and saying, he can't be asking that, that it must be something more complicated. But in fact, I do sometimes ask really simple questions, and you'd better be able to answer them. I like your optimism, misplaced though it is. No, you had no. Nobody has failed.
No.
Maybe you weren't here the day I told you that people don't fail my classes. At most, one person in here might fail. Yeah. Okay. It could be. It's mathematically possible. But not likely. We've got, finally, an answer for the vector potential in our magnetized sphere problem, then you can take the curl of it in your vast spare time if you want, either inside or outside, and you should find the answer we derived using the first method. Okay, there's a slightly more complicated variant of this problem I was thinking of doing next. It's actually not much more complicated. In fact, it can use most of what we just solved, which is to now take our uniformly magnetized sphere and stick it into an external magnetic field that's uniform. Okay, maybe I'll erase that too. Okay. Okay, so we've got our sphere. It has some magnetization, M, and now we're going to put it in this uniform field directed along the z-axis. So if we're assuming this is a hard ferromagnet, then just applying a magnetic field to it won't change the magnetization density. And we simply have to use linearity. We simply add this constant B field to the field we had before. So the B field inside becomes B naught plus what we found in the last problem, 2/3 mu naught M, which I guess I called equation one. And B outside is B naught plus mu naught over 4 pi, magnetic field of the point dipole, effective point dipole, which we said the sphere represents. We can just grab the formula for a point dipole. If you don't want to take the curl of the gradient of that formula I wrote earlier, (3n(n)m minus m all over r cubed. It's equation two. We don't need the delta function term because we're outside of the origin. Again, m is the volume of the sphere times the magnetization density. H inside is B inside over mu naught minus M, which is B naught over mu naught minus 1/3 M, right? And H outside is B out over mu naught, right, since M is zero outside the sphere. Okay, that was just adding two things together and nothing too deep. What is a little more interesting is to do a uniform field applied to a sphere of constant permeability. No, so now it's not a fixed magnetization density inside, but now we have a linear medium inside the sphere. Yeah. Actually, I don't remember this comment of Jackson, and I'm not sure what he's talking about off the top of my head. If you come to office hours in your vast spare time, we can talk about it, and I'll try to think through what the hell he was talking about.
Yeah.
Well, I'll have to think about that. I don't remember the comment. Okay, so we have a sphere again. And we have a linear permeability, mu. And we have an external B field, which is uniform. Okay, so let's draw the situation. We have our sphere, it again has radius A, has permeability mu. We're going to have this external B field. And let me again pretend to be Mahito Komoto. There are no free currents, so curl of H is zero. And that means we can write, as we always can when there are no free currents, H is minus del phi m. And del dot B is zero, always, and so del squared phi m is zero, both in and out inside the sphere. So we know how to solve Laplace's equation. Just this is the toolkit we painstakingly developed earlier in the course. So we have spherical geometry. Should we use Cartesian coordinates? You like that. Okay, you solve it that way and show me the solution tomorrow. I will do it in spherical coordinates. And what are the solutions of Laplace's equation inside and out? Well, we have azimuthal symmetry, might as well use Legendre polynomials instead of YLMs, just to get rid of the phi coordinate. I think you'll all agree with me that these are the only solutions that will be valid inside the sphere. The other independent solution that goes like r to the minus l minus 1 would lead to divergences on physical at the origin. So only the r to the l can be present inside in this Legendre. And that's the most general solution of Laplace's equation that's cylindrically or axially symmetric, I should say. It's the only one. It's got to have that form where BL are, at the moment, unknown constants. phi outside has a sum of terms, different constants, dl, r to the minus l minus 1, pl of cos theta. These terms are all totally fine. They will not diverge at infinity. But in order to produce this constant field at infinity, we will need one more term. I'll call it C1R P1 of cos theta. Only that term, which is of this type, is allowed because we're going to need a term that gives the constant field at infinity. And in particular, we want to impose that as a boundary condition. At r goes to infinity, we have to have minus del phi m is h naught z hat, which is b naught over mu naught z hat. And so that tells us right away what C1 has to be, minus b naught over mu naught. But we're still left with these two infinities of constants BL and AL we have to find by imposing the boundary conditions. Now, we have at the surface of the sphere is where we'll impose the boundary conditions, of course. And we have the normal component of B is continuous, and we have the parallel components of H are continuous, kind of like the parallel components of E were continuous in the dielectric media. But we found there that the parallel boundary condition is basically equivalent to demanding that the scalar potential be continuous. And so I'm going to do it that way instead of demanding the parallel component. But you could also check, make sure you see that that gives the same answer. Okay, so continuity of phi m at r equals a gives the following equation, bl a to the l for phi in. And we'll just equate these term by term, right? Because the P1 has to match the P1 terms. BL A to the L has to equal C1A Kronecker delta L comma 1 plus DL over A to the L plus 1. That's our first equation from phi being continuous. And now continuity of the radial component of B means that mu h inside at r equals a, the radial component, I'll just put an r subscript on h to indicate the radial component, right? That's mu naught h r outside at r equals a. And that is, in terms of phi, says that minus d phi m in dr at r equals a has to equal minus mu naught over mu of inside d phi out dr at r equals a. That equation is sparing you the algebra, a line of algebra that gives LBL a to the L minus 1 equals mu naught over mu times C1 Kronecker delta L comma 1 minus L plus 1 quantity DL a to the minus L minus 2. Now, one interesting thing is you can see before you start sort of just plugging this into Mathematica or something, is that if L is different from 1, this term disappears. This term disappears. And now you have a 2 by 2 linear homogeneous equations. In Nebraska, we grow up pronouncing that homogeneous. Don't do that, though. It'll really make me mad. Homogeneous, please. Homogeneous. Two homogeneous equations with two unknowns has a non-trivial solution only if the determinant of coefficients is zero. Here, that determinant is not equal to zero. And so only the trivial solution, BL equals zero, DL equals zero, survive. That's odd to say that those are zero and they're surviving. I guess they're actually not surviving. They're zero. They are destroyed by this argument altogether. Only the L equals one have a non-trivial solution because that's 2 by 2 linear and inhomogeneous. And this is serving as the inhomogeneity in those equations when L is 1. So we only have two constants we solve for, B1 and D1. We had already solved for C1. And so I'll write all that out next time. I'm out of time. We'll see you on Tuesday. Again, was very lonely in office hours this week. Not a soul came to see me and comfort me in my sad state, crying at my little round table.
Hi. Can I ask you?
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you.
Let me stop the recorder.